Okay, thank you for being patient. Welcome to the last panel presentation of the day, of day four, here at Liminal Village, Expanding Consciousness. I'm very excited to participate in this eclectic and rock star of psychedelic panel here with four friends of mine who I've known for a long time and gotten into plenty of mischief with. Intellectual mischief, that is, of course. Rick Doblin, as you know, is the executive director and founder of MAPS. The Tea Fairy is what we'd like to call a psychedelic raconteur. She is a psychonaut extraordinaire. Her work on Arrowhead is becoming legendary, and she's also one of my favorite people. So. And then there's Mitch Schultz, director of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, filmmaker from Austin, Texas, man with big ideas and an even bigger heart. And I'm sure all of you know Daniel Pinchbeck. His work is very well known, and his contribution to this meme is very well known. So everybody welcome Daniel as well. Okay, so we can bitch about the drug war all night long, and Lord knows I did it for at least an hour, but what good does bitching about it do without coming up with a tangible solution? The purpose of this panel is to look at what a post-prohibition world might look like and how we might get there. In other words, how we can have boom festivals all over the world and not worry about police presence, prison, criminal justice. Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate that enthusiasm. So, all four people on this panel and myself have all spent quite a bit of time in our own particular ways and in our own particular fields trying to advance the cause of a post-prohibition world, a place where drug use is acknowledged and respected as part of our day-to-day lives. What we're going to do is go through the panel really quick, starting with myself and then going through to Daniel, and everybody will kind of explain their personal connection to this issue and what their personal mission is as far as advancing a post-prohibition agenda and what type of work they're doing for it. That way you'll get kind of a feel for the different types of work that's being done and all the different types of angles that you can attack this problem. So I'll start really quick. As I mentioned, my name is Charles Shaw. I'm an author and filmmaker. I also spent a number of years working as an activist with certain reform groups like the Drug Policy Alliance, Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, and the Marijuana Policy Project. My documentary project, the Exile Nation Project, I'm using the word project a lot because we have a lot of projects in the United States, was an open source, Creative Commons based oral history archive of people that were giving testimonies as to their experiences with our drug law system, our system of prohibition, and our system of criminal justice. I've worked on campaigns to try to bring medical cannabis to the state of Illinois, my former home, where I lived in Chicago for many, many years. And in everything that I do these days, I attempt to advance the cause of normalization when it comes to drug use, and to, in any way that we can, get to a place where we decriminalize drug use, stop punishing people for it, and divert all of that valuable time and resource into better and more dire needs, such as education and housing and job training and so on and so forth. That being said, let's move on to Mr. Doblin.
Well, I think in order to move to a post-prohibition world, we need to understand what's really driving a prohibition world. And a lot of it is fear, generated in part intentionally to keep certain systems in place. And if we can understand what those fears are coming from and how we can address them, then I think we can really move a little bit towards relaxing and opening up. And the fears, I think, are now threefold. They're focused on psychedelics influencing people and inspiring them to promote cultural change that somehow or other challenges the status quo in a dangerous way. But I think if you look around here at Boom with the windmills, with the way in which the structures are here, the way in which the systems are meant to be sustainable, that This is not the Timothy Leary turn in, tune on, drop out. This is something that is trying to relate to the world's issues and also try to develop new innovative technologies. So I think that's one of the big legacies from the 60s, was that this young culture, the counterculture, would get so inspired by what they were doing, but so completely reject the system that they would try to create their own private utopia and go live on communes on the land and move away. And I think that that's fundamentally destructive. The whole idea of a counterculture, I think, brings down doom on your head when you identify that way, because you're small, the culture is bigger, and you sort of built in conflict. I think the other part of the fear is the fear that we all have, that if the social controls are taken off, that somehow our deep inner urges, that we will become rapists or we will become murderers, so that we need this veneer of society, of social control, so that we can avoid, you know, hurting each other. And that once we take the lid off, which is what often happens with psychedelics, that there is something, what's coming up is going to be fundamentally destructive. And I think when you look at things that have been suppressed, they get twisted and warped from that suppression. And once you let them out, sometimes, you know, they're not that pretty at first. And that's the challenge, is to try to create context where we can undo this repression and let our core energies come up, but do it in a way where we can refine and channel them. And so how do we address? Some people don't want to do that work, and so if there are others that are doing that work, it sort of creates a sense of obligation on people. And if they're scared to do it, rather than do their own work, they'll try to stop other people from doing it, so they don't see that example. So we have to bring in these tools and these technologies that do offer these opportunities for culture to be scared, but that if we can find ways to contextualize them, to administer them in careful ways, that we can replace fear with hope. The hope for healing, the hope for a more peaceful death, the hope for spiritual experiences directly. So one of the challenges constantly. Okay, so I'll just be very quick. So it's three things then that I did here to bring a post-prohibition world. Well, the first thing is I bought 100 grams of MDMA. Now, that sounds bad, but what it actually was doing was I was buying legal MDMA that will be for use in research that is going to solve a problem throughout Europe. A lot of the teams have run out of MDMA. So I solved that. Then I ended up trying to deal with DEA requirements for two of our studies, one in Canada and one in Boulder, where their fears are so exaggerated that we have to install bulletproof glass all around the whole pharmacy, where there's $1,500 worth of MDMA in a safe, hidden in a closet, you know, alarmed and everything. So the thing is, we just have to address the fears. And then the other thing that I think is the biggest was that I moved forward our project with the U.S. military in terms of trying to work with them. And there's a 10-week residential program for people who are in the military that have post-traumatic stress disorder, and this is the last hope, 10 weeks. And if they do not get cured of PTSD, they get transferred to the VA, costs $1.5 million a year on average for their treatment. And so now we're moving towards being able to do an MDMA PTSD study in this 10-week residential period. So I think addressing, finding where the culture is opening, finding what they're fearful of, and seeing if we can come in to transform that. That's, I think, the way to build a post-prohibition world.
I'm gonna bring us back to our original question, which was, what connects you to this issue, and what's your specific avenue of change that you'd like to employ here? Rick's basically given us MAPS's program for the next 5 years. The good thing is he actually has more, and I'm sure he'll fill the rest of the hour with it. But yeah, let's get back to your personal connection to it and the avenues that you're working in.
Okay, well, I write for Arrowhead.org, which is a fantastic psychedelic information site. Yeah, give it up for Arrowhead. And I feel like one of the best things that we can do is collect data and to testify about the types of experiences that we're having. I think that if, as we're able to build a consensus, about, wow, you know, people are regularly having these transformative experiences. People are regularly being healed in this way. People are regularly being able to free themselves from addiction. People are having these interpersonal bonding experiences, and then beyond that, you know, the other 99% of reality. And I think that the way to bring this thing is through seduction, through showing people, wow, you know, maybe they're missing something. You make this art, and they say, wow, you know, is it really that you're contacting these other entities, or is it really that you're, you know, healing yourself and you're having these heart open experiences? People are being cured from PTSD, end of life anxiety. And these studies are already out there. These guys are doing it. Spirit Molecule is a great example of, like, taking a piece of media and going, look, there's this awesome thing that maybe you don't know about this. And the more people who really understand that this possibility is out here, the more people are going to say, wow, you know, this is a basic human right. I think we need to seduce, I think we need to get the 1% high. I think we need to get the movers and the shakers high, like get behind the scenes and take them in the back room and say, hey, you know, this is what's really going on. And I think that's probably going to be one of the things that does the most good. It's hard to fight things with pushing against, but, you know, I want to pull them towards.
Just as a side note, that actually was a tactic used during the acid revolution in the 60s, and there were a number of people who tried to get acid to the most influential people, and there's lots of stories that John F. Kennedy was dosed, and that led to his whole change on ending the Cold War and all of that. So check that out when you get a chance. Mitch.
Again, my name is Mitch Schultz. As Charles mentioned, I'm a filmmaker, in general, just a media maker. And through my own personal experience, I had tried psychedelics from pretty early age and in a pretty reckless way. I don't think that there was any kind of responsibility behind it or any thought. There was something maybe I was chasing, but those experiences, you know, from the age of about 14, 15 years old up into my maybe mid-20s, didn't do anything for me, and I think there was a lot of other things that were under the surface. So when I had this bigger experience into my early 30s, all of that kind of came forward at once, and all of a sudden my life had changed in a very quick time. And so I started to think about, all right, how am I going to go out and communicate this with people and try to understand what the hell just happened to me? So I'm kind of coming at it from a very personal perspective, but as I go out and I start to talk to people and communicate some of these ideas that I've been struggling with and trying to work through in my life, a lot of other people have these stories as well. And as DeFerry was saying, it's important for us, I think, to start documenting this on a pretty regular level. There's almost research going on amongst this community, and it's important information that could play a big role down the road to start having people say, okay, there was a particular sensation that came along with this. I was in this particular state. I was feeling this particular way. We can start to catalog that a little bit more. And of course, the research that MAPS and a variety of other researchers around the world are starting to do is do just that. But that's a small percentage, and there's a lot bigger percentage of us out there that maybe explore these realms. So to be able to kind of pull it in on a personal level, but then how that's going to feed into the broader culture, hopefully, eventually. So that's kind of where I'm coming at it. I'm trying to sneak in the back door with media that is sexy, hopefully, and seductive, but also smart and engaging, and at least opens up some ideas, or at least opens up some thoughts for people to say, hey, I'm not thinking about this necessarily in that way, but it makes me think this, and just start to play with it a little bit. So my goal is to start pushing some media out there that's really just going to ask a lot of questions and hopefully let all of us come to conclusions on a broader scale. So, yeah.
The question exactly was what again?
What's your connection to this issue
of
wanting to end prohibition
and prohibition.
Push us to a prohibition world?
Right.
And what avenues are you using?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said before, Charles, that the war on drugs is a war on consciousness. And, you know, that, as you also talked about, I totally agree with you about the surplus labor population. It's basically being used as a social control mechanism. And on the one hand, it keeps down, especially in the United States, the minority and poor populations. And on the other hand, on the other extreme, it stops, you know, those, you know, who might access these other levels of awareness or go through a process of deconditioning that people were starting to have in the 1960s, where they then confronted all the problems of the society, ecologically, socially, and at every other level. So yeah, those are the two reasons for this war on drugs, I would imagine. I mean, I've tried to contest it, you know, through, you know, writing a book, or Breaking Open the Head, where I explained why, for me, these experiences were extremely valuable and important. And now through Reality Sandwich, we've had hundreds of writers probably on similar subjects. And now through Evolver, we're sort of seeking to create communities where people discuss and share information and ideas, and also not see the drugs, you know, see the drugs as one part of a larger constellation, you know, of issues and ideas that we need to address, you know, culturally.
Okay, the next question I'd like, and we'll come back to Rick, is knowing what we know today about the psychedelic revolution of the 60s and the introduction of psychedelics to the culture, what have we learned in the interim 40-some years that will help us go about it differently?
Okay. Well, I'll take a brief moment and answer your first question, because I didn't answer. Basically, when I had my bar mitzvah when I was 13, I was under the belief that it would turn me into a man. And I remember waiting in bed after the next morning, and I thought I was just the same. And then I started telling myself, God must have been busy. This must have been a lot of people who got bar mitzvah. And so after a week, I finally realized that the ritual didn't have the power that I wanted it to do. So when I first did LSD at 17, I thought, aha, this is something that can turn me into a man. And then the other part was Hitler and the incredible way in which people can project and scapegoat, and trying to find tools that could get down deeper below that kind of and help people deal with it. So that's kind of my personal connection. So the idea of the mistakes of the 60s, or what we learned from the 60s, well, I mentioned already one, the idea that a counterculture, when you self-define as a counterculture, I think you're doomed. The other part is that we were too enamored of psychedelics, and it was like one dose miracle cure, and you're permanently enlightened, and you're smarter than everybody else. So there was an enormous arrogance and naivete about how it was all supposedly in the power of these drugs, and the emphasis on the integration and working to learn from the drug experience and build yourself more towards that without the drugs, that was lost. So I think that that was then. The other big thing was that when you respond to your opponent by mirroring what they do, you're lost. So what I mean by that is that Tim Leary and others were spokespeople, and they saw that the government was massively misinforming people and was exaggerating the risks. This whole thing about how LSD caused chromosome damage and it would cause, you know, birth defects. The first date I had with my wife, she said she, you know, was kind of leaping pretty quickly, but she said she would never want to have kids with me because I had done all this LSD. So I think this massive misinformation was coupled with a suppression of the research, shutting it down, and a denial of the benefits. So in response, Tim and others exaggerated the benefits and minimized the risks. And so when you're in a situation like that, you're going to have a lot of people come unprepared for the power of the psychedelic experience, and a substantial number of them will have problems, in a sense, the reason for cosmic care. So what we have to do, and what MAPS is trying to do, is to find a middle path where we're very interested in understanding the risks of these drugs, and we want to understand them in a credible way, and we want to become the expert on the risks, and we also want to become the experts on the benefits, but we don't really want to exaggerate them. So I think those are the main lessons I've got from the 60s. The other is just that we see more and more, you talked about global warming, there is no private utopia. There is no where to run. I mean, we are totally all in this together. And to think that, like Aldous Huxley in his book Island, you know, he changed that book as he was writing it. It was this utopian island, and at the end of it, it got destroyed by the powers of corporate oil. So there is no way to run. We have to go to the heart of the system and change it in that way. I think when we can do all those, we'll really promote change.
Wow, I wasn't there in the 60s, but I feel like that super flowering was sort of a first enunciation of something. So when this thing first landed, there was a rush to go, wow, what is it? and to start to apply models to it. And so people say, oh, okay, is it like, you know, Eastern mysticism? Is it psychomimetic? Does it, you know, imitate psychosis? And then, you know, later as we sort of like discovered more about shamanism, we're saying, oh, okay, well, is it, you know, is this a model that we can use? And now, you know, we're reaching out to other models. I had this ayahuasca trip where Mama comes on like a sentient browser program. I was like, I'm scanning you for, you know, patches and cookies and checking you for viruses before logging you on to hyperspace proper. And like, there's so many new ways to start thinking about it. And I think that one difference is that was suddenly psychedelic culture landing all at once. And I think now there's an existing standing wave of psychedelic culture. So now you have festivals like this and you have cultures like this that are already in place. And so as new people start to come into it, they're not all coming onto it at once. They have something like elders in the community who are able to, you know, point them towards sources of information and kind of give them a sense of what's probably going on for them. They have stuff like Cosmic Hair. And I think it's just that, you know, we've started to already have a culture that's in place for it that's really making a difference now.
I think there are a couple things, I guess, that we've learned or that I think that we have now that can kind of benefit us. I think one of those, in a lot of ways, and I wouldn't be all end all, but technology and even some of the science that we've been able to discover, if you will, or open some doors to, and this can go from quantum physics all the way down to just computer codes. It gives us a different perspective on what the potentials are. So it gives us some space to say, okay, maybe there is something more to this that we don't quite understand. The second part about it, I think, is time and having a perspective away from, you know, the hustle and bustle of what happened as soon as these cultures slammed in together. Essentially coming out of World War II and having a large portion, not large, but a pretty good number of people in a culture and a group of young people that were coming into adulthood to have this smash, if you will. That's a big connection, and all that's kind of finally shaking out a little bit, and we're able to kind of revisit these things and say, all right, there was some really solid work that was going on at that time. We were asking some decent questions, but this kind of cultural hysteria that came out of it put things away. So now looking back at that with a little more, less emotion attached to it, I think is going to help a lot. And then trying to navigate that again with the technology. How do we start to use some of these new technologies to put some new models on our research, even spiritual states? So I think kind of those two things.
So I guess I would say that there's been an evolution also in the connection a lot of people in the modern world have to indigenous shamanic practices. So a lot more people, I mean, in the 60s, this stuff had kind of erupted, you know, into the world, and there was very little context for it, as other guys pointed out here. But, you know, one of the main contexts that's emerged is these indigenous cultures, you know, especially in South America and North America, and their, you know, lineage of using these plants for you know, generations, if not millennia, and their availability to us now to you know, have that experience with them. And, you know, I think there's something very important, you know, if you want to explore, you know, these types of visionary states with sacred plants, there's something very important about connecting to a lineage, you know, maybe a couple of lineages. It's you know, it's like a morphogenetic field of protection that maybe goes back many generations. So I think that's one of the main things that I see. And then once again, for me, like, we get a little bit hyper fixated on psychedelic this and psychedelic that. I mean, I've also worked with the Kogi tribe in Colombia, who don't use any psychedelics. They understood, I mean, we did retreats with them where they understood why we were drinking the ayahuasca, but for them, you know, the men chew coca leaves, the women just weave, but, you know, their main thing is that we have to recognize that, you know, that we're out of balance, and the way to get back into balance is to kind of reestablish our connection between the spiritual and the natural world, like creating a reciprocal relationship with Mother Earth. You know, so that's kind of their context for thinking about what they call younger brother, which is their way of referring to our civilization.
So, granted, it's a broad-based question, but What to you would a post-prohibition world look like? What would it look like physically? What would it look like politically? And what would it look like psycho-spiritually?
Well, okay, if Boom was in a post-prohibition world, it would be very similar to the way it is, except instead of having energy control, where you can take your pills to be analyzed, they would be sold at the mini market, and they would be standardized and pure. And you would probably need to show your ID. You would probably not have it. You'd need to not have caused problems with these drugs, and then you probably need to be over a certain age. And if you are under a certain age, you would need your parents' permission. So I think that there will be these age limits, but I think there'll be a parental override. But other than that, there wouldn't be police searching people coming in. And it would be just a little bit healthier and more positive because of the anxiety and stress that is caused by the unknown purity of drugs, the police presence, things like that. I think in the larger world, if we want to look at the transitions that happened in the state of California over the last 30 or so years, they used to have around 12% of their budget went towards education, and around 6% of their budget went towards prisons. And what's happened is that those numbers have shifted. So now there's more money, almost twice as much money, going to prisons than education. And the education system in the state of California was a jewel, and it's now being degraded. So in a post-prohibition world, we would reverse those flows, and we would put another priority on education. We would also have more respect for individual rights. The power of the state to tell you what drugs you can and cannot do is often, as we've talked about, used to suppress minorities, used for other reasons than to reduce drug abuse. Just the same way that they characterize it, drug use non-medically equals drug abuse. Everything that's going on here at Boom is drug abuse in the traditional perspective. So I think we would have a much different understanding, and we would have support systems paid for by the taxes on the drugs that people buy, and people would be offered help. My father was a pediatrician, and he worked on some of the early crack baby studies, and his job was to analyze the babies. And he started telling me early on that these babies were not really as bad off as they were made to seem, and they would recover. And what he said was that the women who are using crack when they're pregnant are so scared of the drug laws and the drug war that they don't want to come in for treatment because their babies will be taken away from them and they'll be charged with a crime. So in a post-prohibition world, it's not going to be utopia. There'll be loads of problems with drugs. But I think people will have opportunities in a non-stigmatized way to go for treatment in a much easier manner. And I think we would then have honest drug education that would start at a young age. And what we have now is not that at all. And on top of it, we would have a culture that valued the range of consciousness that is our potential. And so instead of an economic model that goes for perpetual growth, we would probably have a more sustainable model, and using the free time, we would be more experimenting spiritually. So I think there's a lot of really compelling reasons to make this move towards a post-prohibition world.
Plants legalized. I'm not Machiavellian enough to want to see heroin vending machines on every corner, so I think that to some extent I feel that just, you know, let it happen and let evolution sort it out, but I'm also compassionate about that. I'd like to see just plants blanketed legalized, and I'd like to see preparations like ayahuasca. Also, you know, they're not just a plant. It really is made in a primitive laboratory. You know, made available to people. I think that it's important to be able to get a hold of empathogens like MDMA for therapeutic use, and even for, you know, recreational use to an extent. I think it's a word that's been tromped on a little bit too much, but recreating yourself is really valuable. A lot of what we're doing here, rejuvenating and reviving and re-inspiring ourselves is important. I think it might be interesting to see what would happen if it was just not allowed to be sold. So if you're growing plant medicines or if you're making medicines and giving them to people through, you know, you have it all tested and everybody knows exactly that you have the real molecule and you're handing it out to people, then it takes the commerce out of it. I don't know if that would work, but it's an interesting idea. No way.
Hello. It would be probably a much happier, a much healthier, safer, more responsible society, I think, overall, just the culture. I always go right back to prohibition in the United States with alcohol. I think you could see in a very short amount of time what happens when libation that is loved all over the world gets pulled. You have organized crime come in, you have murder, you have stealing, and there's a whole range of things that come out of that. So even just looking at that as a really quick snapshot about how bad it was and also how bad it is and is getting because of all these kind of restrictions that are placed on these things, I think you can revert back to a more openness, a healthier description. And just through the education process, which is a big one that these two have mentioned, that helps pull a lot of those guises off of the whole thing. So we can actually move forward and say, you know what, it's okay, let's discuss this thing 100%, instead of shove it in a closet, and then having it taken over by an economic structure that has absolutely no connection to doing something positive with that. So I think, again, just being able to I think explore responsibly, but also be able to start going out and explaining these ideas and concepts to friends and family and educating others at the same time is going to give us that healthier space. So,
Sort of tailing off from the end of Rick's comment about the expanding spiritual aspects. One thing that I got really fascinated about, if you think about all of these, the biggest possible, like, Hollywood movies that are, like, the most successful, you know, like Star Wars, The Matrix, Avatar, and Harry Potter, they all essentially are telling the same story, which is that, the young hero, needs to go through an initiation to gain access to their, like, higher faculties, their psychic capabilities, their chi or their power or whatever. One idea would be, okay, these are just fantasies, these are just things that the culture is projecting, but maybe those are actually tapping into, like, a very deep yearning that we have, for that type of opportunity to actually, training facilities, learning facilities, where this exploration of other forms of consciousness becomes, like, for some people, their committed path, And once again, I feel that in that shift, we're going to learn a lot and gain a lot from building much closer relationships with intact indigenous people, like the Kogi or the Sequoia from Ecuador, who we work with in Costa Rica, who really still hold the keys for what that archaic technology is all about.
Okay. Building on what Daniel just said, so in traditional societies, there has been a kind of shamanic lineage and a cultural reinforcement of the spiritual traditions using plant medicines. But let's envision a post-prohibition world where suddenly all of those things are available readily. Where I come from in California, you can pay $400 to drink ayahuasca with a gringo who's been to Peru once and call it a spiritual awakening. There doesn't seem to be much regulation on this, and there seems to be a lot of people that don't have the best intention or have any understanding of the lineage or the practice performing spiritual work. How would you regulate something like this? How would you make something like this standardized, and how would you integrate a shamanic practice like this into our kind of daily lives? And this is an open question, so let's not go up and down the line. Anybody want to jump in on that?
Well, I wouldn't actually want to regulate it personally. I guess I think that's, yeah, I mean, obviously there are tricksters, but also everybody, I mean, this what's great about the whole subject of psychedelics, and actually what's almost been good about them being illegal, is that they've forced people to develop a lot more of discernment to explore them. I mean, you have to overcome, like, social prohibitions, legal prohibitions, and so on. You know, and then you make this exploration. I think the same thing, you know, hopefully would apply, and I guess maybe I'm speaking too ideally, and in the real world there's a lot of different levels in which people are having experiences, but, you know, that hopefully we would reach a level where if you're seeking this experience of a shaman, you know, and you know, you're gonna do the research, you know, you're gonna talk to people, you know, you're not just gonna, like, wander into the first, you know, shaman on who's got a stall open. You know, you're gonna check what's been written about them on the internet, what you know, talk to people who've had experiences with them, and really make sure that it's a good situation. I mean, another aspect of what we've learned about, you know, shamanism, you know, since the 60s and before, is that, you know, it's not always a good thing. You know, I mean, you know, shamans has become our cultural archetype of, you know, the healer. We've taken one aspect of what goes on, but there's also a lot of sorcery in the Amazon. You know, a lot of use of, you know, visionary plants for negative purposes. You know, so it's going to require, you know, a lot of development of discernment, and hopefully people will be a little bit, you know, cautious and patient. You know, not everybody has to have, you know, that experience right away. Even, you know, it's really up to the individual calling, but then also, you know, having the, you know, self-knowledge to really research it for yourself, so that you feel really safe with and happy with the experience that you have.
Yeah, I was talking about this in Peru recently. You know, if you drive a tuk-tuk in Peru, you can make $5 a day in Iquitos, and if you give ayahuasca to white people, you can get them to pay $100 a pop, so it's more than an order of magnitude. And so, you know, you can get ayahuasca in Balin Market for $5, so it's, you know, obviously there's a lot of charlatanism that goes on. But I've been talking down there about how awesome it would be if we could get a real school together, you know, a real center where a bunch of different shamans were able to work together, and you could have actual classes like Icarus 101 and Botany of the Amazon and Brain Science and Transpersonal Psychology, and, you know, you could have Western people come in and teach, and then, you know, people could come in for, like, an exploration or a healing or a reset, and the students could help with that, and you could really make a whole thing out of it if they were able to work together. But it seems that, unfortunately, right now there's so much kind of shamanismo, and I'm the baddest shaman in the Amazon, there's a lot of difficulty getting people to go in on something like that. But I think that maybe the women, I'm hoping the curanderos would maybe get more behind this cooperative vibe and try to build something up, and then I hope that could be a model for, you know, when it opens up in the Western, you know, well, I guess that is the West, but when it opens up for us, there'll already be these models of awesome schools where there's an awesome recording studio and an art gallery, and we can record these Icaros. Every time a shaman dies in the Amazon, we lose 30,000 years worth of songs. It's got to get an awesome recording studio, so I think making a nice center would be awesome, that's not just run by one shaman or one interest, but that's really collective from all over different parts of the Amazon or different parts of the world even.
Check. I think there's a lot of the, you know, similar to what Daniel was saying, there's a lot that I don't think our Western mind frame kind of fits into that model. I keep coming to that more and more within myself, but I think Boom and these festivals are a perfect example about the meshing of those two things, where we are able to kind of get back to a simpler, hopefully a more responsible relationship with nature and things around us. And also getting back to some of the tribal dance moves, gathering together as community, discussing ideas. So we're starting to kind of see some of that shake out. I think we'll be able to kind of integrate and borrow some of theirs ideas. But at the same time, I'm not really sure that full-on experiences for everybody to go down to the Amazon may be the best way. I think there's a lot of this culture, too, that's coming back even to the United States with the UDV and the Santo Daime, and how those two worlds that are completely different have started to figure out some sort of an integration. So I don't see it being a full, here we go, let's take the shamanism model, let's drop it in the middle of the United States or into Europe. It really is a blending, and I think you can look around here and see that. There's a lot of commonalities between the ideas and the relationships that are stood there, but then how are we making this more of a modern thing? The Arqueros are absolutely beautiful, but I know that we also have a different perspective on what music is now. You can listen to it right now, and how are we setting these songs up and how we're moving to the world in a more spiritual way, but using some of those traditional models in some way. Don't disregard them, I guess.
Is it just me or is Alchemy Circle getting louder by the minute?
Louder.
Yeah? Okay, can I get some volume on this, please?
Thanks.
Enough boring questions for me. You guys came all this way to see these folks, so I'm going to open up the questions to the audience, for any of the panelists, including myself. So please feel free to ask. And this gentleman will be our first contestant on the Psychedelic Is Right. Shamanic culture ourselves out of that, out of the Western scientific mindset, and then come up with own scientific rituals, shamanic practices out of the West, out of our culture. That would have been so cool. Okay, how to formulate it into a question? Yeah, just say something about it, maybe. I don't know. Can we please have questions for the panel? If you want to give a speech, we can talk later, but we just really want to have questions. Let's go with this gentleman right here.
Let's
respond
to it. What was there actually a question? Was really important. And if we look back in the 60s, there were sort of two schools. One was Timothy Leary and the Richard Albert, Ralph Metzner from Harvard, and they kind of adopted the Tibetan Book of the Dead as a way to understand what was going on. They published the book, The Psychedelic Experience. And on the West Coast was more like Ken Kesey, the Merry Pranksters, and the Grateful Dead. And I think what has really lasted is the festivals, the Grateful Dead, that kind of approach, because it came from our own culture. And I think it's all too easy to romanticize shamanism, but there's a lot of sort of cultural embedded problems related to the power dynamics in shamanism. Sometimes the shaman takes the drug and does all the healing to the person. So that doesn't empower the person. The churches, the ayahuasca churches, are patriarchal, are homophobic, hierarchical. They're not a model, I don't think. They're an obstacle more than a model, but they're still encased opportunities for these powerful experiences. So I think the first thing is that we do really need to bring it into our own cultural context. I think we need to rely heavily on science to separate out all the different things that we know. And there are nice things that we can adopt from the shamanistic model, but I think it has to arise from our own culture, from the Western scientific culture, and how do we integrate it in that way? And I think if we can do that, we'll have lasting structures that can sustain over time and can respond to those of us that really do have a critical mind, that are very interested in self-empowerment rather than having a power imbalance, as often is the case in shamanism.
I think that's all. I think I agree with you, actually. But I would want to say that
surprisingly.
But I still feel that, you know, because we didn't have that connection with those indigenous cultures, we didn't have that lineage, that's one reason why it went off the tracks in the 60s. I mean, you know, ayahuasca is certainly having a much deeper, different influence than LSD did. And, you know, what happened in the 60s is because people didn't really have anything there was no ground under their feet, you know, so you even had, like, you know, like Timothy Leary, I think it was like 2 years after he started taking LSD that he was like the man to go to hear about it. You know, John Lennon talked about how he took acid so often that he felt like he destroyed his own ego, and it took him like years to sort of put himself back together. So people really weren't, they didn't have, there was no lineage then, you know, and that was a big problem. So hopefully, you know, part of what, you know, quote unquote 2012 or whatever this transition is the completion of that kind of initiatory voyage for the modern Western psyche, you know, that came to its first full expression, you know, first expression in the 60s, and maybe, you know, we have that capacity to bring it into a much fuller expression going forward.
Yeah, well, like Dan has said, we don't necessarily want to import the entities and traditions and viruses of Amazonian shamanism into a new field, but we do want to import the basics, 30,000 years worth of knowledge. How do you move your avatar around in the space? You know, how do you protect yourself against certain things? How, you know, we want to get their interpretation to add to our pile of interpretations, but we don't necessarily want to import everything that they have going, because I think that we may be able to build something that's more culturally appropriate for us, and, you know, that doesn't have such a, like you said, the little history of throwing little darts at each other as being a big part of it.
Okay, we have another question here.
Yeah, this is more like a political question. What do you think of the strategy that the psychedelic movement would support the police in order for them to have more resources to fight down white-collar business criminals?
I think going after white-collar criminals is a really good idea. I don't see how that has anything to do with what the police decide to do about drugs. So I don't quite see a link. So I think it's obviously the case that too many people are getting away with financial manipulation, white collar crime. But that's not in itself going to address. With the end of the Cold War, what really drove the spread of the U.S. military was the drug war. And if you look at the DEA and the way that they were spread throughout the world and the DEA outposts, they're moving more and more with CIA, their intelligence gathering organizations, so that we are using the drug war as kind of a screen in some ways for American imperialism. And I think that's going to be hard to undo. But I think going after white collar criminals is a separate issue.
I have a question. So as it stands, most of the Western banking world is kind of fueled by the profits from the drug trade. I mean, it's estimated that something on the order of $500 billion to $1 trillion a year are laundered through the Western system. It's laundered through real estate and businesses and banking and so on and so forth. In many ways, it's argued that it's propping up this system. What happens when that money is taken out, when it's legitimized, and what type of a, you know, political and economic shakeup are we going to see in the event that that happens?
I think you'll see a whole shift from, you know, criminal syndicates producing drugs to pharmaceutical companies, others. I mean, again, there's no perfect solution, but the money is still there. People are still paying for it, but that there's an enormous price that we're paying in violence. There's another thing called search time, how long it takes you to find the drugs that you're looking for, that would be reduced. I think the financial systems can cope if we legitimize, and in fact, most economists are interested in ending underground markets because they think it makes the system healthier. So I'll say one thing also is that if you look from a national security perspective, I actually at one point tried to get a job in the CIA, and they came recruiting at my college. And what I wanted to do was a national security study of the implications of legalizing drugs. At the time, the Contras were smuggling cocaine, going after the Sandinistas in Central America. So the CIA, the Northern Alliance that we worked with to take over Afghanistan, fueled by opium and heroin profits. So the fellow that I spoke to said that they're not even looking at that. And then about 5 years later, this was 1990, around 95, the biggest part of the CIA that it staffed up was about 150 people, was their counter-narcotics. And so I went to this guy, I said, you have all of these war games that we do with the military on all these different scenarios. Do you have anybody looking at what are the implications for national security of legalizing drugs? And he said, no, we're not supposed to look at that. So I think that we would have a much more secure world if the drugs were legalized, and I wouldn't worry that much about the financial institutions. They'll find a way to cope.
More questions? Yes, this gentleman over here.
Would the panel advocate sharing psychedelic experiences with their children? And if so, to make everything safer all round, would they advocate publishing instructions on how to make, in particular, LSD, so that we know, we're sure about what we're giving to our children?
Check. Could you repeat the last part of that? Publish the ideas?
It's very difficult to get to be sure about the substances that you're offered. Would the panel advocate open source access to step-by-step instructions to make psychedelics?
Well, they're already there on the internet, on Arrowhead. I think the more important question, part of your question, is about parents teaching their kids. And I went to a Native American church peyote ceremony for celebrating somebody's wedding. And what was very impressive to me is that there was a father that was there with his 8-year-old son who took small amounts of peyote and stayed up the whole night. So having the kind of initiatory experiences within your family is crucial. And I can't tell you how many of my friends hide the fact that they smoke pot from their own kids. And that is so corrosive. The kids figure it out, and you're destroying the opportunity to educate as you see fit. And people are scared that their kids will be taken away from them, different kind of things. So I think that it's crucial that we have an understanding that the home is where this kind of education should be taking place. Whether people want to introduce their kids or not is a whole different story, but in 23 states in the United States, 23 out of 50, there's a law that says that parents can legally give alcohol to their kids at home. It's illegal in 27 states, but almost half the states have said that the parental override of the alcohol age limits is something that's very important. So I think we need to have systems like that. And actually, we have on the MAPS website, to try to build information about this, we have a section called Families Who Value Psychedelics. And we're collecting stories from both generations. So if any of you are here and you were introduced to psychedelics by your parents, or you were introduced to your kids to psychedelics or marijuana, we would really like to post your stories anonymously on our website to show that that can be a wholesome situation. I think most people run the other way. It sounds so scary. But I think that that's really the core of a lot of education that should be taking place at home.
Agreed. And also, I think it's you know, the responsibility of talking to your child at the same time, not just about the psychedelics, but there's all these other aspects that fit into it, from the social structure and trying to be able to explain, you know, how this is perceived in an outside environment and potentially compared to an internal family matter, or how it's looked at with your friends. And the parents' friends aren't going to want friends to come over if you're going to have these things there. So there's all these other different elements, from relationships to societal stuff, that need to be addressed at the same time about talking just about the psychedelics. We don't want to get caught up in just that, but hopefully these things are opening up a lot of other doors for us to explore. So also looking at all these other aspects and explaining, you know, as many of those as you can in some sort of relationship to that psychedelic. And it also, I think, opens it up beyond just the psychedelics for how and what that means.
Well, there's a lot of models of it in indigenous cultures, you know, the initiatory experiences around, you know, puberty, and that's been common for millennia, but also in some of, like, ayahuasca cultures, they use it actually giving birth. You know, the baby's born with ayahuasca in their system in some cases, and some groups do ceremonies every new and full moon where they just put a little bit, you know, in the gums of babies or put it on their forehead, and it's something that's always been a part of them. And you're also making a decision for your kid not to do that. I'm not saying that I would necessarily do it or at what age, but I feel like, you know, that I've had a shaman in the Amazon say, well, of course you suck at this. What if you tried to start learning language when you were 18 years old? You know, when your brain is already completely developed. So it's just an interesting perspective.
I guess my thing with just having a child, and obviously I've thought about it in relationship with her, you know, just really about how do we respect like the sanctity and autonomy of the individual, you know, and I will just, you know, wait to hear from her, you know, without any pressure from her, you know, how and if and whether, you know, this is the type of experience that she wants to explore, and then we'll, you know, look at it, you know, but probably not for some years.
We have another question here.
How do you think that you could reduce the violence transitioning into a legal economy from like a black market economy, for instance, in the U.S. with the cartels pushing in drugs from the south? Like, how do you think that you could implement a system to reduce violence, or what sort of violence do you think could come from a legal transition? And what ways do you think that we could promote that?
I'd like to answer that first, if you don't mind, folks, in saying that the first thing that the United States can do is stop shipping guns to Colombia and Mexico. That's a first step. So much of the violence down there is because of these multi-billion dollar plans like Plan Colombia and the Meridian Initiative that essentially creates the problem that it then goes and fights against. So there wasn't a cartel violence problem until we passed this Meridian Initiative and put a right-wing government into power that decided to go and use these guns to fight these cartels. In response to that, the United States was able to slam the border shut even harder and be even tougher on Mexican immigration. I see that personally as using the drug war as a vehicle for fighting immigration and to shut the border, okay? And I'm open to debate on this if people think of something different. But our government has been driving the drug war for 50, 60 some years in some form or another, going all the way back to the Uniform Convention at the United Nations in 1965, if I'm correct. And so all other nations, if they want to get American aid or American military assistance or anything like this, they have to adopt our prohibition plan. Thankfully, Europe certainly led the way. It's starting to break apart from that. People are starting to turn away. But I think there's also a lot that the people here in Europe can do by putting pressure on their elected officials, because they seem to listen to you here on this continent, and unlike where I'm from, and potentially use that avenue to change it.
Well, we have an existing model already in our history that's not so far back, which is the ending of alcohol prohibition. And the violence and the criminal gangs and the impure drugs that poison people caused actually women to rise up. So it was initially Women's Christian Temperance Union that wanted their husbands to not spend so much money on alcohol, not go to the bars, spend more money on the kids, and a sort of moral position. And then under prohibition, it got so twisted with the violence and the speakeasies and the sort of lure of the you know, the Roaring Twenties and all, that it was mostly women's groups that had the largest organization that ended prohibition. But once they ended prohibition, the violence from alcohol sales pretty much went away. So I don't think you need much in the way of preparation. You're going to see that the criminal groups will go to other crimes when they've lost an opportunity to make it through drugs. So you need to crack down on them pretty hard as they try to find new opportunities to, make money through criminal endeavors. But, you know, here at the festival, we sell alcohol. I mean, when was the last time any of us saw violence created, you know, in relationship to the alcohol market? There's violence according to alcohol use, but the sales. There's some tobacco. There's not much violence in tobacco. It's when tobacco is smuggled in from Canada, where the taxes are lower, or from Indian reservations, there's violence in the underground sort of marketing of tobacco getting around taxes. But really, we can be pretty assured, based on the lessons of history, that the market-related violence, once you have a functioning court system and people can settle disputes in other ways other than through violence, it'll go away.
Okay, do we have any questions over here on this side? Any women want to ask a question? We've had like a sausage party here on the questions thing for a while. No one? Oh, here we go. Thank you, ladies.
I know it's fairly depressing, but how do you think we should deal with our politicians who, by the way, are absolutely no better than America in Europe? We've just thrown Greece to the dogs, and we're planning to throw Portugal to the dogs, and so I would admire us. What can we do in our relationships with our elected officials to make them understand the need to change?
Rick, you seem to be the most appropriate person to field that question first, since you have to deal with the government regularly.
Well, for us, the big thing is that the Army has more guns than the DEA. And that's our basic strategy right now. So we're finding that by working with the military, the DEA was slowing up the licensing for the doctor that was going to do our study. We're doing now a study in 24 U.S. veterans with chronic treatment-resistant PTSD. And there was an article that I was quoted in saying that the DEA was putting the drug war over the health of the veterans. And within a week, Dr. Michael Midhofer got a call from the DEA saying that his licenses were on the way, and they apologized for taking so long. So I think you need to find corresponding points of leverage. Now, with politicians, we've got the problem now that rich people can donate unlimited amounts of money. So it's really hard to fight that. So we've got more and more of a system that's very difficult. And there's, in the United States, all of these efforts to disenfranchise poor people through voter ID laws and things like that, people that tend to vote more Democratic. So I think what we need to do is try to get people out to vote, to take the, not to reject the system, but to participate in it, and then eventually to show politicians that they won't lose office if they adopt some sort of legalization position. We have President Obama, who is now given the drug war to the right wing, to the DEA. He's decided that it's too hot of a topic for him to try to do anything in terms of reform at this stage. So he doesn't feel like he pays a political price. But if you look around from our perspective, there was so much enthusiasm for Obama in 2008 among young people and others, and now that's vastly diminished. So I think he's miscalculated on certain things. But how you get politicians is you just have to develop countervailing power, and you put pressure on them in all different ways that you can think of.
I don't know if this is a direct answer to the question, but just a quick story with regards to that. I think, first of all, a big part of that is really just getting out there and talking about these things. We can talk about it amongst the community, and I think we're kind of setting some stones down for us to continue, moving forward. But we need to really expand this whole thing. I recently met with a U.S. congressman who's been one of the longest-serving U.S. congressmen and served on the Judiciary Committee, and was able to hand him a copy of DMT, the spirit molecule. He had no idea what it was, just out of a nice gesture, and said, "Oh, thank you, I'll watch it this weekend." And I didn't hear from him, on Monday, and waited another week, and I think it was about 2.5 weeks later, I did just shoot him an email, and I got a short response back, and it was, he was really pissed in a lot of ways, and it was very kind of to the point, but I felt like there was a slight pause towards the end about just opening up and not knowing, because he didn't know about the UDB case that went through the Supreme Court. And I think as one of the longest serving members of a Congress and going through and seeing these cases, you don't know anything about them, was troublesome to me, but hopefully to him, even though he would completely disagree with it. So I guess the point I'm trying to get to is really getting out there, and maybe we can't meet with politicians all the time directly, but starting it on this ground level, and it starts to filter up, and they start to see what's happening, and people having benefits from this, whether it be soldiers or spiritual experiences for people that really transform their lives. I think that's part of it again.
Okay, we have another question over here.
What's the situation with the water in? So is everything? There's been some controversy on the campsite with some people drinking some of the water. Doesn't really have anything to do with this, but you are the boom panel.
I don't think we know anything about that.
No?
No. Hi. Can you tell us how you feel that the end of Prohibition would affect the pharmaceutical companies jumping in and taking over and having access to safety plants like ayahuasca?
Did you hear that?
Yeah, that's a good point. Under a system of legal markets, what about the big corporations and how are they going to handle this incredible market? So I think that there may be some, it's difficult to control advertising for free speech rights, but I think there may be some limits that could be placed on advertising. It's possible that the provision of drugs could be through a nonprofit corporation, because when you have a for-profit corporation that's mission is to maximize profits, and the shareholders can sue the board of directors and sue the managers of this corporation if they're not maximizing profits, then you get all these perverse incentives, like the tobacco companies marketing to kids through cartoon characters and things like that. So it is an issue, and I think one possibility is to work with nonprofits or social benefit corporations, where their goal is to provide access for a wide variety, but not to make the last penny on the last person that will buy their drugs. At the same time, in a legal market, people will be able to grow their own marijuana. We would need to create an alternative to the pharmaceutical industry for certain things like the plants that you could grow yourselves. It's harder to do for chemicals, but if the drugs themselves were not legal, you could find recipes, you could make stuff. So there'd be some kind of, right now people can set up operations in their house to make a certain amount of alcohol in the United States. So I think that the key part is that if a corporation must maximize profits and they're selling a drug that has either addictive properties or it could be potentially dangerous in certain circumstances, that's a recipe for trouble, but that's still better than leaving it to the underground criminal market.
But I just wanted to say that I've been thinking about the last three questions, and the question about violence in the drug war, and the question about how to deal with elected officials, and the question about the pharmaceutical companies. In a way, they're all asking about how do we deal with the sociopathy in our society. And from my perspective, everything that Rick does is completely amazing, and I very much am grateful and honor the work that he's doing to make these tools available, through the system. Somehow there needs to be some type of archetypal or mythical intervention, because the sociopaths have to sort of be shown a different way also, I think about this actually in relationship to ancient civilizations like Egypt or the Mayan, the Aztec civilization. It's not like they just had like the good god and the demon, and you only worship the good god. They would actually have temples for these different deities, who represented these different aspects of the psyche. So you would have, Horus temples or Quetzalcoatl temples, but you also have temples for Set or Tezcatlipoca. And it would be kind of recognized that there were people who have, a tendency, which you could see as sociopathy, which is a negative tendency in a certain respect, but it's kind of part of like our tendency to be like hunters, seekers, thrill catchers. You have to take that wolf-like tendency and you have to harness it in some way. You have to create some kind of structure where it's not devastating to the society at large, which is what we now have. So I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I wanted to put it out to you in that framework. Just as you have these ancient cultures which kind of recognize these polar principles, whether it's Set and Horus or Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca, whatever emergence into, postmodern, archaic, revival, future, pan-anarchic civilization we're going to have to construct, is going to have to figure out a way to honor these polar principles rather than creating a dualism so the suppressed part of the psyche, goes underground and then submerges within these power structures.
Okay, let's speak practically for a second here.
That was practical.
So we're all trying to get to a post-prohibition world, right? We'd all like to enjoy the freedoms of it, but what are we doing to get there? I know in my country, most of the people that are working for this are a very small minority that are very committed to it. And they usually have a personal connection to the issue. When I was filming my first documentary, I met this guy, an old activist named Chuck Armsbury. And we were talking about advocating for prisoners. And he said, you know, the only people that care about this issue are prisoners and people who love them. And they're the only ones who come out and work for this. So because of that, the prison reform movement, the drug reform movement, they're very small and they're easily marginalized. Yet they are populated with extremely passionate people. But to really get to a post-prohibition world, we're going to have to get past all of that. We're going to have more involvement. Okay? How do we do that?
I think we heard before where you're suggesting, Gary, that drugs be, people could grow them, but there would be no markets.
That's not a positive idea.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, because what we need is tax money to show that from a government perspective, if you bring these things up from the underground, it's going to be a source of a lot of money. And so there's been a study by Jeffrey Myron at Harvard University, an economist, who says that in the United States, if marijuana were legal, it would be in the range of $12 billion a year that would be benefiting the American economy, being paid to the government, or money saved from the criminal justice system. So I think one way, when you have a moral war, the drug war for many people is not a rational process. It's based on this sense that staying in control is really good and that these drugs are evil. And what we need to really do is separate out. It's not about the drugs. It's about the behavior. It's about what the drugs do. The drugs are overwhelmed by the cultural context, which we see in ayahuasca and other kind of communities, where the cultural context can really control or steer the drug experience more so. So I think we need to look at what does the society need. We're in a financial crisis everywhere, so unfortunately, though, the moral arguments don't completely work, but when you start matching them with reducing violence, with increasing tax income, people start paying attention.
More questions? Yes, this gentleman over here. Just going to have to hop over a bunch of sleeping hippies here. So pardon me. Just 1 second.
Okay. In regards to the use of MDMA to treat PTSD in soldiers, does the panel feel that there's any danger of, in a post-prohibition world, the government using psychedelics to enforce or further destructive and oppressive policies? And does the panel also feel that the use of MDMA to treat PTSD in soldiers is a beneficial thing, or be worried about consequences of that?
Well, yeah, I've been expecting that sort of question. So the same thing is the case as far as a medical doctor, an army doctor, right? Somebody gets injured, you patch them up. Are you facilitating them going back on the battlefield and killing more people? Yes, you are. But there's a humanitarian aspect to it. I do think that from what little we've seen about the veterans who have had PTSD from the war and have had MDMA therapy, they're not like, okay, I killed a bunch of babies, now I'm ready to go back and kill more. You know, I think there's something about the getting in touch with emotional complexity and depth that impacts them in a lot of different ways. The project that we're talking about now with the 10-week residential program, the goal of that program is to return people to active service. So I think if we can get the principles of healing, of compassion for yourself and for others, of dealing with trauma, in the long run, my sense is that we're not emboldening the military to create whatever atrocities they want to create, and then we'll wipe the people's minds clean. I think it's more likely to have a beneficial experience. But it's an interesting question. But I don't think any of us would say, you know, that we should eliminate, or maybe some people would, you know, in an army, they should have no doctors or something. It's a difficult question.
The U.S. Army spent years trying to find a way to weaponize LSD and other derivatives, and most of their efforts fell flat on their face. In fact, it kind of had the exact opposite effect, if you think about it, when it was finally released on the public. So, I don't know. How many, by show of hands here, how many people here have been in trouble with the law for drugs?
Okay. How many people here were afraid of getting in trouble with the law coming here for drugs? Nobody? You guys are all perfectly confident that none of you would get in any trouble. What's that, sir? That's Miguel. That's my buddy Miguel. Okay, well, I can tell you that the people on the build crew definitely didn't feel that way. Even though we're in Portugal, there was definitely a feeling of be careful. How many people here would like to see that feeling go away? Okay. So what are we going to do about it? What's the first step?
Well, I think if we look at other models, so the gay rights model, where most people knew somebody is gay, they just didn't know they knew somebody was gay. And when people would stand up and say, I'm gay, people would be like, how can that be? I'm shocked, but you seem like a normal person. So I think the drug users, because part of our behavior is criminalized, tend to stay in the shadows. But I think if we could have more people who, and we're seeing that we're having an enormous cohort of aging baby boomers who are now reaching retirement age, and they're not worried about their jobs, they've raised their kids. So what we're trying to do for our 70th anniversary of the discovery of LSD, our conference in April from 18th to the 22nd in Oakland, we're trying to gather stories from 700 people or so about their LSD experiences. So I think we need coming out. When people talk about LSD, it's pretty rare that they don't mention Steve Jobs and him endorsing the idea that LSD was one of the three most important things he did in his life. So it's amazing how many people you talk to in private have had powerful experiences from psychedelics, but other people don't know it. And so I think we need to follow the gay rights movement and find the courage and speak about our own experiences in a more public setting. And that, I think, will change things more than anything else.
So you think we should have, like, drug pride parades and, like, public displays of... I mean, I'm being dead serious. You know, that public display in the gay rights movement was a huge part of the reason why they were able to get there.
Yeah, I think
what
so.
What do? We hide in festivals here inside, you know, little mountains.
Well, I think when you go back, you know, you talk to your parents, you talk to your siblings, you talk to your family members, that I think that's the way things will spread. People are so distrustful of the information that they get about drugs from the media, because it's often so twisted, that they rely on personal experience. So, like, how many of you have spoken with your parents about your use of drugs? A bunch. That's really good. And how many have had good reactions when you've done that? Fewer. But still, it starts a process, and I think that's really what we can all do with our close friends and family.
What do you think about in-your-face practices like smokeouts?
I mean, it is interesting. We're seeing more mainstream media, you know, picking up. Like, New York Times Magazine just had a feature on psychedelics as medicine, which Rick had some really awesome quotes in. So we're definitely seeing more openness in the mainstream. So I think it's a question of, there's not just one avenue. Obviously, there's numbers of different avenues, and everybody, you know, can follow those avenues out. I mean, from my perspective, it's, you know, this idea of media, counter, you know, alternative media to a certain extent, and then also having gatherings where people are brought together to learn about, you know, this area. I think the idea of having, you know, connecting with people who are powerful, who, you know, might be at this point in their careers willing to step forward and say, yes, LSD was an extremely powerful experience for me and a greatly valuable one. That would be tremendous if we could get 50 of those people, like, you know, Paul McCartney. I mean, come on, guy, what do you got to lose, you know? Different technology people, you know, Google, you know, the Google folks, you know, they're all at Burning Man every year. They're most likely exploring this area. At a certain point, I think that could change the tone and the inflection of the whole cultural discourse. Because at the moment, it's all the right wing keeps pushing one way. There hasn't been a really strong voice of in the opposite direction.
What about direct action, like smokeouts, or like what David Bronner does by digging up the DEA's lawn?
Yeah, well, I think you have to be aware that what we're trying to do is communicate to a frightened mainstream culture. So that if you have a bunch of high school and college students smoking out on the Boston Common, I don't know that that's really changing people's attitudes in the public in a positive way. I think the people at the end of their lives, at the end of their careers, coming out and saying, I'm a respected person in society, for these are my accomplishments, and drugs were a part of my life and evolution, that's the kind of stuff. As far as direct action, David Bronner's the grandson, his grandfather made Bronner soaps, and he's built it up. He just had an action in front of the White House where he made a cage, an iron cage. He had it dropped off, and inside he processed hemp. So in the United States, you cannot grow hemp. And China is the biggest exporter of hemp in the world, and the United States is the biggest importer of hemp in the world. And in the United States, you cannot grow hemp. So he brought in some hemp seeds, grew them to maturity, brought them right in front of the White House, processed them into hemp oil, put it on his toast. The police came, the fire department came. They had these big saws, and he made it so that it would take them longer to break in than for him to process the hemp. And it got a lot of publicity, and he didn't do it in a violent way. He didn't hurt anybody. So that's the kind of thing that I think can be really effective. And David Bronner is going to be joining the board of directors of MAPS. Yay. Because I like that kind of action. And in fact, we bonded on our mutual lawsuits against the DEA, where he's trying to get a license to grow hemp, we're trying to get a license to grow marijuana. So you have to be really media savvy, though, that there should be no violence, nobody gets hurt, but you make a point. And I think those, when people put themselves on the line, it's a strong message to a lot of people.
Do you think people should be willing to go to prison for this cause? I mean, I know I did, but I wouldn't recommend it to a lot of people.
I hope not.
Well, I'll say this. When I was 18, it was the last year of the lottery in the Vietnam War, and I decided that I would be a draft resister and I would go to prison. And so I decided that I would just never register, and I assumed, of course, that they would find me. And so months go by, and nobody came knocking at my door. And then I had this moral dilemma, which was, should I tell them that I didn't register so they will put me in jail? And, you know, Martin Luther King has talked about how people that violate a law and suffer the consequences willingly have the greatest respect for the law. But the more I thought about it, I realized that if I could just create the positive alternative, which for me was working with psychedelics and trying to bring them out for more spiritual purposes, healing purposes, that would be a better use than me being another person in jail. So I think if you can kind of find ways to bring forth your perspective and, I'd say try to avoid going to jail if you can.
Yeah, but obviously it's an individual choice, right? I mean, like the kids in New York who moved down to the Occupy Wall Street encampment and put their lives on the line and got nerve damage from being flexi-cuffed and had to, you know, spend days in prison, and then they got redness scan or whatever, or, you know, I don't have the guts to do that at this age and state of my life, but I admire them and respect them so much for having that courage. And, I try to live with that courage in other aspects of my life. And so I think it's an individual choice, but definitely having the courage to, you know, fully represent your convictions in the world, that's something that the world needs a lot more of right now.
I think we ought to make cognitive liberty a bigger, sexier issue. I think that, you know, somebody ought to come up with a cool symbol for it, so there's like a little button that you can have, like a flag pin that's like, hey, I support cognitive liberty, and people can do it pretty subtly. And I think that it's going to be a bigger deal as we get better and better drugs and better technologies that affect the brain. Well, okay, you know, there's this thing that just improves my memory. It gives me 30% more memory. Should I be allowed to take that? Should they be allowed to stop me? And as things that sort of are a little bit less drastic and a little bit more dialed in come up, I think that it'll get to be more and more of a mainstream issue. And I could definitely see it being something that rock stars pick up or whatever, you know, cognitive liberty, whatever. Just, raising awareness of it as a hip issue in cultures like this.
Final question, yes or no, will we see prohibition end in our lifetime?
I think that people under 50 will see it. People over 50, maybe not. maybe, maybe not, but things can change pretty quickly, and the system is eroding, it's collapsing under its own weight, as I described with California, where more money goes into, twice as much goes into prisons than education. I think we'll have MDMA legal as a medicine in 10 years, but then there could be a 20, 30 year rollout for really society to transition in a more fuller way.
Yeah, I plan to live a real long time. I think we'll either see it or we'll see the end of the world, not necessarily causally, but if, you know, everything blows up, then obviously we won't have gotten there. But if we manage to make it through to where we can live for hundreds of years, then we'll probably see a whole lot of change we don't expect. That would be one of the first things.
Yes, I think we will on some level. I don't know to what extent, but it was a question I used to ask myself growing up all the time. It's like, are we going to see marijuana legalized? Are we going to see marijuana legalized? And I was like, yeah, I think we will. And I think we're starting to see that. So that's kind of what I go back to. And I don't know what that's going to be, a full-fledged idealist kind of, here it is, just go do it. But I think on some level we've got to. I mean, it's a cognitive liberty issue. We've got to be able to allow this individual freedom to be able to continue to thrive, to make humanity a better place.
Yes.
So I
just a second. Hold on.
My answer is based on economics. Looking at the United States, there are 2.5 million people employed in the criminal justice system, spending about $200 to $300 billion a year. $60 billion of that specifically for the drug war. That's a lot of money and a lot of jobs. Until we can find a place for all those people to work and for all that money to go, I don't see anything changing.
Okay, what I was going to say is that I think the question is it worth the struggle to try to build a post-prohibition world, even if you might not see it? And for that, the answer is clearly yes. So I think that doesn't really matter if we're going to see it in our lives or not. You talk to the people who tried to end slavery starting in 1750, they never saw it. So for me, the way that I've been able to not burn out for doing this work for about 40 years is that I've not been so focused on outcomes. If you focus on outcomes, you can get depressed, you can lose your energy. But if you focus on the process, if it's an enjoyable struggle, it doesn't really matter if it'll be in my generation or your generation.
All right, that concludes our panel. Okay, Daniel has a final comment as usual.
Well, I just, you know, this whole thing that you're saying about these jobs, you know, I mean, that for me would be part of the paradigm shift, you know, that somebody like Buckminster Fuller talked about, that, you know, maybe there aren't going to be jobs for everybody in the same way in the future. Maybe that was an industrial age kind of way of looking at, you know, what we do as people. And, you know, there could be other things that people do with their lives, you know, like live in healthy communities and grow a lot of their own food and learn crafts and so on. You know, that it just seemed like there were a lot of, you know, ideas of a model that in itself I don't think can sustain itself in that comment. So I just wanted to address that.
So you think it'll collapse on its own weight before we get to like a policy shift point?
Maybe.
Yeah. Let's hope so.
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes day 4 of Liminal Village, Expanding Consciousness, and this panel, Building a Post-Prohibition World. Let's give it up for the panelists. All right, hippies, time to dance. Have a good evening.